What I want to talk about now is the one of the central concepts, really one of the most important concepts in the Jewish concept of mystical prayer, which is called kavana. Okay, the term kavana is found in the most normative Jewish texts on not just on prayer, but on normative ritual action in general, even not even a question of ritual action, in assessing one's the state of mind in judicial issues as well. So it's a fairly broad term, and the mystical concept of kavana is built upon the normative concept. The normative concept appears in the Talmud throughout, and as you follow a kind of, if I could categorize the various levels or dimensions of kavana, and actually there's an awareness of different levels of kavana in the Talmud, we'll be able to, I think, see how it builds up to the mystical concept. I would translate kavana, well, the word itself from kivun means direction. Kavana is usually translated as intent or intentionality, to give it a phenomenological definition, sometimes as focus, okay? And it has all of those qualities, sort of intentionality in the more general sense, and focus. The in its most normative and usually judicial context and ritual context, the basic level of kavana or intentionality is just, I have a little, like, for you to make it easier, I just wrote these categories on the board. The lowest level of intent or intentionality is just general awareness of the act that you are doing. And this, in other words, to assess whether somebody is responsible for his action or not, to assess whether somebody fulfilled a religious precept by, whether it's in prayer or some other religious action. The basic level is, was the person aware that he was acting at all? Okay, as opposed to doing something totally mindlessly, which we often do. This level of intentionality or of kavana has no particular sanctity to it. It's just basic awareness that you are acting. Built upon that is a higher level of kavana or intent that is demanded in some actions, particularly in some ritual actions, which is awareness of the basic religious meaning of the action. In other words, that you are doing an action that fulfills the divine will as expressed in scripture or in Jewish law. In other words, that you are doing what's called a mitzvah, you know, divine commandment. Again, this is not mystical. This is just that there's a set body of commandments, and you realize that the act that you're doing fulfills one of those, and you're doing it for that purpose in a very discreet way with no higher or transcendent awareness. This is the way that most of the religion is practiced by most people. If they get to this level, this is wonderful. Okay? A higher level of intent that is actually also referred to in the normative body of law called the Talmud, actually in the Mishnah itself, which is the original redaction of the oral law, is a level of intent where there's an awareness that one's action occurs in a divine context in general. In other words, an awareness of God, and that one's action or one's prayer particularly is in a more general way directed to God. These first two levels, God, in level one, awareness of God isn't even there. You're just aware that you're acting. Level two, God's very much on the horizon, just or you know, beyond the horizon, but not in an upfront and focused way in the forefront of one's consciousness. Level three is where you do have an awareness of God, which you cultivate before the action is done, or through the action, or beyond the action. To give an example, this is a very standard text from the Mishnah. Again, this is the normative codification of the oral law. It's talking about how to pray. And it says, one should not stand, it's the tractate Berachot 30b, if you're interested. One should not stand to pray except from an attitude of solemnity. The pious ones of former times used to delay for an hour, or wait for an hour, and then pray in order to direct their hearts to their Father in heaven. Okay, so they would not just get up and pray, but they would wait for an hour. A much later commentary, Maimonides suggests that the idea of, let me quote, the idea of delay is what is called waiting. That is, they would wait before prayer for an hour, during which time they would cease conversation and cease all thought, and then begin to pray. Okay, so it's cease conversation and cease thought, stop thought, and pray in a state of total awareness and mindfulness. Now, this level of awareness, which again is quite normative in one sense, in that it's included in a normative text of law, has also a, at least the way that it's presented, an elitist kind of connotation. In other words, even this, which we would think is a fairly minimal level of religious or spiritual awareness, is, according to this text, not really for everybody. It says only the pious ones of former times used to do this practice to cultivate an awareness of God while they prayed. In other words, they would do this practice. It was hoped that one could have this awareness of God even without the practice, but the pious ones of former times would cultivate the practice themselves. Pious ones of former times is a statement meaning that we don't do it anymore. However, when the discussion is taken up by the Gemara, which is the Talmud, which is the discussions of rabbinic scholars from Amoraic period from the end of the 2nd century to the 5th into the 6th century, it reads like this. It is taught that one who is about to pray must wait an hour before prayer and an hour after prayer. Okay, so now it becomes normative. One must wait an hour before prayer and an hour after prayer. And in fact, this is codified normatively in the great 16th century code of law, the Shulchan Aruch, by Rav Yosef Karo. We spoke about when we were in Tzfat. This is the most standard, you know, code of law that every observant Jew abides by and reads very frequently. And it's right there. It says you must wait an hour before prayer and then pray. Of course, in terms of ceasing all thought, that's not done. I don't say of course, that's how it's developed. There are introductions to the prayer in terms of psalms, an extensive section of psalms which may or may not have been intended to stand in for this kind of waiting period. It's not quite clear. But it's codified in law, not practiced by Jews on a normative basis. Usually it's if people practice it at all, it's fairly an individual basis. The Talmud goes on and says, the pious ones of former times would wait an hour, then pray an hour, and wait again for an hour. And this they would do three times a day. Okay, so the prayers three times a day. So the Talmud asks the obvious question, you know, if they're waiting 9 hours a day in prayer, and they're spending 9 hours a day in prayer, how do they maintain their Torah learning, and how does their work get done? Okay, so the Talmud answers, since they're pious people, their Torah is maintained and their work is blessed, so everything gets done easily. Okay, but the idea is that, I was thinking of Jamal's discussion about how Moshe helped Muhammad whittle down the number of times to pray. There's also another problem, is how long you pray, you know, each of those times, and there tends to be an inflation of this in over history, in Jewish history, there's the times of praying get longer and longer and longer. Generally. Okay, so at this level we're still in really very normative territory. But there was an awareness that even these three levels of kavanah, of focused intent, don't exhaust spiritual possibilities and really don't go that far. And you find in the in philosophic and Kabbalistic discussions, philosophic discussions from the, from the 11th century on, and Kabbalistic discussions from the 12th century on, a concern with attaining higher levels of focus and focus of attention, higher levels of awareness in devotional practice. Maimonides, for instance, at the end of the 12th century, very cusp of the 13th century, in his philosophic work, Guide of the Perplexed, devotes a good portion of a chapter, it's part 3, chapter 51 of the Guide of the Perplexed, which is a pure philosophic, well, applied philosophic, but it's a straight philosophic work. It's not a Kabbalistic work, though it has mystical overtones, which are undeniable, I think, and quite pronounced. And in this particular chapter, part 3, chapter 51, he talks about quality of intention that one must cultivate to be a serious spiritual person. And the he notes, for instance, that if you, I'll do a little bit of quoting, sort of running quoting here. He says, your goal should be to act as if you are occupied with God, may he be exalted, and not with anything other than God. If, however, you pray merely by moving your lips while facing a wall, and at the same time you think about buying and selling, or you read the Torah with your tongue while your heart is set upon building of your house and does not consider what you read, and similarly, in all cases in which you perform a commandment merely with your limbs as if you were digging a hole in the ground, without reflecting upon the meaning of the action or upon God from whom the commandment proceeds, or upon the end or goal of your action, you should not think that you've achieved the purpose. Okay? So he's aware of the common state of awareness of most people is that not particularly mindful. So he goes on to suggest a very basic mindfulness exercise or series of exercises. Let me just quote just briefly at length. From here on, I will begin to give you guidance with regard to the form of this training that you so you should achieve this end. He says, first thing is that you should cause your soul, while reciting the Shema prayer, the prayer in which we proclaim the unity of God, you should cause your soul, cause your soul. When you're reciting the Shema prayer, right? In other words, the Shema prayer, by which you state the unity of God, in a way that you should empty your mind. Shema is the prayer. The Shema means to hear. It's the verse, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." You should empty your mind of everything, and pray in this way. You should not content yourself with being intent, focused while reciting the first verse of the Shema, but reciting the entire thing. When this has been carried out and practiced consistently for years, cause your soul, whenever you read or listen to the Torah, to be constantly directed, the whole of you and your thought, towards reflection on what you are listening to or reading. In other words, without distraction, without mind wandering. Just when you read, read. You know, when you listen, listen. When you pray, pray. This kind of idea. When this too has been practiced consistently for a certain time, cause your soul to be in such a way that your thought is always completely free of distraction and gives heed to all that you are reading and all that you are doing, so that you aim at meditating on what you are uttering and considering its meaning. Okay. He goes on to say that, and he gives further practice. This is mindfulness in its most basic form. Then he describes the goal of such a practice. There may be a human individual who, through his apprehension of the true realities and his joy in what he has apprehended, achieves a state in which he talks with people and is occupied with his bodily necessities while his intellect is wholly turned towards him, God, may he be exalted, so that in his heart he is always in God's presence, may he be exalted, while outwardly he is with people in the sort of way described by the poetical parables that have been invented for these notions. He quotes Song of Songs, "I sleep, but my heart awakes. The voice of my beloved knocks." And I may be dealing with the outside world, but I'm totally mindful in what I'm doing. So in other words, and which he describes as the ideal state. It's not a state of withdrawal from the world, but engagement in the world, and yet total awareness of God in every act of engagement. This concept of the ideal state of awareness is picked up by a later commentator, a Kabbalist, Nachmanides, Moshe ben Nachman. You trying to get some trouble on that? Yeah. Okay. Part 3, chapter 51. The Nachmanides picks this up in his Torah commentary and has an interesting discussion. He says that the state of what he calls Devekut, spelled in English, D-E-V-E-K-U-T, Devekut, which means abiding, adhering to the mindfulness of God. The state of Dvaikut, he says, is such, and he describes it in Maimonides' terms, that no matter what you can do, you might be talking with other people, but you are fully mindful of God at all times. And that this, he says, is the condition of Olam Haba, the world to come, which is usually understood as a situation of total self, well, total religious spiritual realization. And he says, but one should live the awareness of the world to come in this world. Okay? This becomes the, and this works its way into Kabbalistic thought from Maimonides, frankly. Okay, so here we have, we're moving to a higher level of mindfulness of the presence of God in everything that one does. Okay, this is still section number three, but taken to its, this is line number three, which is awareness of God before, through, and beyond the action that one does, taken to its highest level. In Kabbalistic thought, the notion of kavanah, of this intent, which is mindfulness, focused intent. You okay? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm fine.
Is everyone okay? Can people hear, can we hear me? Is it clearer now that I'm just to the sound or not?
It's a little more trouble. That's good, I think. The explorations into the notion of intentionality taken to a much higher level in 13th century Kabbalah and on. And we get and we'll see an example of this in a moment, examples of focus on the spherot, on the divine attributes of God, both for theurgic purposes and for a kind of development of a state of mind at the same time. It goes beyond mere theurgy. I guess this is my theme, at least in almost every one of the talks I've given, that Kabbalah goes way beyond mere theurgic practice where one's actions are regarded as merely stimulating God. That's not enough, certainly in the most spiritual levels of Kabbalistic practice. Even with some kind of theurgic concept is present in higher Kabbalistic thought, there's a profound experiential dimension that's expected, and another level of awareness that's expected. So we'll find, and we'll see this in the text that we're going to look in just a moment, the focus on sphirot, which are divine attributes, awareness of God, where you develop an experiential awareness of the significance of a mystical or even on a mystical level or even on a philosophical level of the meaning of one's action or of one's prayer or of one's meditation. So it becomes an experiential awareness. So, for instance, a Kabbalist may have in mind a certain exercise where he tries to conceptually unify the spherot in his mind, unification practice, often focused on practice of meditating on divine names, each of which also refers to different divine attributes or angles or aspects of God's revelation or God's action. And so we have a practice of, for instance, combining two divine names, one name which evokes the sense of God's immanence, another name which evokes the sense of God's transcendence, and thinking the thought together. Okay, and it's called a yichud, a unification practice, and in doing that, you could do this on a theurgic level, in which all you do is think the thought together and hope that that does something, or you can do that as it was intended to do, as you find it in Abulafian mysticism in the late 13th century, and find it certainly later on in Lurianic Kabbalah, which picks up a strong element of Abulafian mysticism, where you're not only expected to think that the kind of superimpose a divine name which evokes immanence and one which evokes transcendence, but to experience that in one's own consciousness and where it takes you. So that develops, again, that so that your mystical intent shifts you into a new state of consciousness, an experiential level. Gertie, you had a question on that?
That microphone, Gertie.
It's right in front of you.
Could you just explain the use of the word philosophical in that context?
Mysticism is not restricted merely to Kabbalists in Jewish medieval history. There were numerous philosophers that had what one would call a real mystical awareness and tried to cultivate practices, Maimonides included. Though he's often pictured as an arch-rationalist, the Guide of the Perplexed is mystical through and through and through. And others who, after from the 13th century on, you often have thinkers who combine philosophical and mystical, Kabbalistic concepts. So you'll find this philosophic awareness, such as achieving unification of God through unity with the active intellect, described in strictly as a mystical state, and I think deservedly so. It's an Aristotelian concept, which becomes in Jewish philosophy an actual mystical experience. I can't account for what it was in Aristotle, but it may have been even that for him. So here you have this focused intent on divine names or certain concepts or ideas which transcend themselves and become representative of divine revelation, leading you to a certain kind of experience. Certainly the most powerful example of this you find in the mysticism of Rabbi Abraham Abulafia in the late 13th century. He developed a very complex, very rigorous and disciplined meditation practice, which included automatic writing, combination of vocalization practices, thought practices, and breathing practices, all superimposed together. All of them you're supposed to do all at once: writing, speaking, thinking, and breathing practices. It's meant to confuse you, and catapult you into extraordinary states of mind. He usually used divine names and combinations and permutations of the letters of divine names for this practice. Sometimes, though, the letters of the Hebrew alphabet were combined and permutated simply on a nonsense level as well, which also had a certain effectiveness for, as he understood it, untying the knots, K-N-O-T-S, of consciousness. I have spoken to people who have practiced this meditation practice, and their current experiences correspond perfectly to the autobiographical experiences we have of Abulafian mystics, which, by the way, is unique. Kabbalah tends not to be not to have an autobiography tradition, spiritual autobiography tradition. Kabbalists are a bit modest about their experiences. They tell you the doctrine, they keep their experiences to themselves. It's a virtue. But in the Abulafian tradition, there's a lot of autobiographical spiritual writing, spiritual diaries, etc. And these Kabbalists describe their experiences as a result of these meditations. And again, these correspond to current practices of people that I'm familiar with, where you are catapulted into extraordinary states of mind. Actually, into different, the way it's described, into different dimensions of reality, different worlds. And not just feeling that your mind is in some different world, but your body is in some different world, fully. You can touch yourself. You can feel yourself. It's a different world. Beings that look differently, that speak to you differently. It's other dimensions of existence. It's hard to explain this, but there seem to be innumerable other such dimensions which an Abulafian Kabbalist can move into and through at will using these techniques. That itself is not yet enlightenment. That's just traveling. But the experience and the opening of one's consciousness through these experiences as a whole leads to very high states of integrated awareness. those who I've spoken to do this practice, I would not say that they are yet at the end or at the stage of total self-realization. And Abu Lafi himself seems to have been at least briefly destabilized by his own meditations. He thought for a while at least that he was the Messiah, and went to Rome to and he knocked on the door of the Vatican to proclaim that he was the Messiah and to ask the Pope to let my people go. It's an interesting story, actually. Take a moment to do this story. I mean, this I think it was Franciscans were there at the time guarding the gate, and they saw this little yidla at the gates of the Vatican claiming he was the Messiah, and then they threw him in jail. And they basically, the intention was they were going to just, they would kill him. He was in jail for about 2 weeks or so, and in this wild state of mind. And the Pope died. It's Pope Nicholas, where are we now? Late 13th century, Nicholas II? Is that in the 1290s? Oh, I don't, all right. I don't even know my Tudor and Elizabethan kings, but the in any case, the Pope dies. There's an interregnum, and somebody remembers that there's this, you know, this guy languishing in a jail cell somewhere, and you know, and what do we do with this this little yid out, you know, in jail? So they say, oh, just let him go. So yeah, they open the doors, and out he goes on his blithe and merry way, you know, in this, you know, wild state of mind that he had attained through his meditations. He apparently comes to himself a little bit later, and sort of gets back his sanity to some extent. But it's a verified story. It's an interesting story too about some of the dangers of these meditation practices. We haven't talked much about that we haven't been focused on meditation per se, but some of these practices are very powerful and play with one's sanity as a method itself. And Abu Lafi and meditation did that. You move in and out of sanity and to achieve an ultimate awareness of the nature of one's consciousness. The kavanah, and we can make a different distinction on this issue of focus in Abu Lafi and meditation, whereas previously the interest in kavanah or focus intent was on the quality of one's attention. In other words, the quality of one's consciousness. The focus gets on to the objects of consciousness, which, and by changing them, either by having exalted objects of consciousness or by rapidly changing objects of consciousness in a method meant to discipline the mind but to confuse the mind at the same time, one is then catapulted into extraordinary states of awareness. So this issue of quality of consciousness, objects of consciousness, as it develops in Kabbalistic thought. And again, this is picked up in Lurianic Kabbalah, some elements of it. Vanessa? No, start now, because I'm going to shift on to a new subject now.
Well, actually, I want to go back to my body for a second.
Yeah.
In preparation for prayer, sorry for bringing you back to
it. That's fine. I'm mindful.
Do you remember, did you ever read the book, The Kiss of God, by Michael Fishbane?
No.
Okay. He talks about this idea of preparation for prayer, but then he uses Maimonides book 3, I think like chapter 53 or something like that, where he talks about the preparation for prayer, and you take it to the point where it gets used as a preparation for death, is how I understood it. But he didn't say it precisely.
It's not familiar to me. He may be talking about an experience of self-effacement, which we're going to see in a moment, which is not death. That would be too strong a description. It's self-effacement. It's nullification of self-awareness of a certain type, or of a certain lower self-awareness. But it's not death. That this might be useful for people who are terminally ill or facing death in a conscious way, I wouldn't doubt that, but that's not its original aim. This is Fishbane. It sounds like a lot of projection, and actually it sounds like projection of certain medieval Catholic themes, Christian themes, onto a Jewish experience. It's not that. Oh, he wants to do that, with Mesirat Nefesh. Yeah. Yeah, it really, he's overlaying a number of issues together here. But all right, we can piece it out when Alon brings the book. I want to look into now, besides this issue of these Yehudim, these using of this either letters or of the divine name, or letters of nonsense syllables, or divine names themselves, and as objects of mind contemplation, there's another tradition in Kabbalistic Kavanah, develop a focused intent, which I want to look at now. And I gave you these sheets, if you have them. There are plenty of them. So if you've got a sheet here. And this is a text from, as far as we can tell, from sort of early to middle 13th century. I would say it's more like middle 13th century. It's in the manuscripts. It appears as a the name is Sha'ar HaKavana LeMekubalim HaRishonim. The gate of focused intent according to the early Kabbalists. So there's no name on the no attribution on the in the manuscripts. Gershom Scholem asserts on the basis of linguistic evidence and conceptual evidence that this is from Rabbeinu Azriel of Harona. I don't know. There's certainly elements of his Kabbalistic system in this text, no question about it, some of his Kabbalistic terminology, but there are aspects of it that, and I think also even linguistic aspects that seem not to be quite his. I think it might be fair to say that it's a Kabbalist influence by him, and that it's it also shows evidence of another school of Kabbalah called the Chug HaIyun, the circle of contemplation. That being said, it's not. It's certainly a nice, juicy mid-13th century text, and worthy of our study. I'm sorry for the small print here. What I'd like to do, even though it's going to take a little time, I want to give you a little flavor of how a medieval Kabbalistic text reads, even though you're getting in Hebrew, just to get a flavor of it, and then to pull out certain themes from the text, without getting too highly technical, because I think it just this is not the forum for that, but to pull out those aspects that I think are themes that we've been dealing with as a group over the last week and a half. Let me read this quickly, okay? You read along with me. I'll make some comments as we go a little bit. He who resolves upon something in his mind with a perfect firmness, for him it becomes the essential thing. That in itself is a significant statement. If you resolve on something, it's a kol hakoveya davar bedato kviyut shalein yeshuv elav ikar. Whoever establishes something in his mind with a complete focus, complete firmness, it becomes essential. This, by the way, is a basic principle in mysticism, generally, basic principle in Kavanah, in Kabbalah, and in any spiritual work that you do. Having absolute, complete, conscious resolve actually makes whatever you resolve real. I mean this in the deepest way. If one can really have complete focus and resolve, you bring that which you focus and resolve on into reality, or you bring yourself to that place. It's an important principle. He says, therefore, if you pray and pronounce the benedictions, or otherwise truly wish to direct the kavanah, focus intent to something, now catch this. Imagine that you are light, and that everything around you is light, light from every direction and every side. And in the light, a throne of light, and on it a brilliant light. Don't get bogged down in the terminology here, but just flow with it. And on it a brilliant light, and opposite it a throne, and on it a good light. And if you stand between them and desire vengeance, turn to the brilliance. And if you desire love, turn to the good. And what comes from your lips should be turned towards its face. And turn towards the right, and you will find shining light, another type of light. Towards the left, you'll find an aura, which is the radiant light. And between them and above them, the light of the kavod. And around it, the light of life. And above it, the crown of light that crowns the desires of the thoughts, that lights up the path of the representations and illumination, and illuminates the brilliance of the visions. And this illumination is unfathomable and infinite. And from its perfect glory proceed grace and benediction, peace and life for those who observe the path of its unification. That was clear. Okay. He's describing here, first, as someone who resolves something in his mind with a perfect firmness becomes the essential thing. Now it goes on to give you a practice for resolving something with perfect firmness. What is this practice? In other words, which he frankly says is, you know, imagine this. Okay, what does this have to do with achieving a state of kavana? Okay, when he says imagine this, this is not real. These lights are not lights in your mind, in that sense. Okay, so everything here is imaginative, and yet what's the function of this imaginative, visualization that he's suggesting? Once you say, imagine that you are light and everything around you is light, light from every direction, every side, what's the effect of that? What's the impact on the mind of that? Well, even before it can do that, though, you're sitting here and everything is not light in all directions and in every way, right? I mean, so what's the first impact of that on the mind? See? Bonnie knows. Okay, so in other words, it faces every other kind of, of dimension of reality, right? So in other words, you've separated yourself. Good. Bonnie does know. You've separated yourself from, the distractions of ordinary reality, which we'll talk about actually in a minute, and establish some other field of awareness, which is frankly imaginative. It's not real, but that's okay. There's an arbitrariness and a built-in arbitrariness to this little practice here. It's not pretending that what you're seeing is real. It's saying that in doing this, you will be able to focus your will, no matter what the practice. Okay, so so establishing a field of light does just as Bonnie said. It sets up something other than ordinary experience, which you now will work with, which gives you a certain freedom to use your mind in a different way.